Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Canto 6, Chapter 1, History of the Life of Ajahnmil, Text 51. Etad sodasha kalam lingam shakti trayam mahat date anusam srutim pumsi harsha shoka payartidam Tare tat sodashash kalam lingam shakti trayam mahat date nu samsvatim pumsi harsha shoka bayartidam tare tat sodashash kalam Linkam shakti tayam mahat date nusam svatim pumsi harsha shoka bayartidam tari tatso dasha kalam lingam shakti tayam mahat Date nusam svatim pumsi harsha shoka bayartidam
Shoka Bayarti Dham Tare Tat Soda Shakalam Lingam Shakti Gayama Kumsi Shoka Bayarti Dham Dosha Dosha Kalam Lingam Shakti Gayama Vaishnavis Tare Tat Sarashakalam Lingam Shakti Prayam Mahat Tate Nusam Shatim Pumsi Arshashoka Bayartidam Tare Tat Sarashakalam Lingam Shakti Trayam Mahat Tatenu Samsutim Pumsi Arshashoka Bayartidam Tare Tat Sodashakalam Lingam Shakti Trayam Mahat Tatenu samsutim pumsi. Arshashoka bayartidam.
Tat, therefore, etat, this, sodasha kalam, made of 16 parts, namely the 10 senses, the mind, and the 5 sense objects. Lingam, the subtle body. Shakti trayam, the effect of the 3 modes of material nature. Mahat, insurmountable. Date, gives. Anasam sutim, almost perpetual rotation and transmigration in different types of bodies. Pumsi, unto the living entity. Harsha, jubilation. Shoka, lamentation. Baya, fear. Arti, misery. Tam, which gives. Translation by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. Please repeat. The subtle body is endowed with 16 parts. The 5 knowledge acquiring senses, the 5 working senses, the 5 objects of sense gratification, and the mind. This subtle body is an effect of the 3 modes of material nature. It is composed of insurmountably strong desires, and therefore it causes the living entity to transmigrate from one body to another. In human life, animal life, and life as a demigod. When the living entity gets the body of a demigod, he is certainly very jubilant. When he gets a human body, he is always in lamentation. And when he gets the body of an animal, he is always afraid. In all conditions, however, he is actually miserable. His miserable condition is called samsriti, or transmigration in material life. Purport. The sum and substance of material conditional life is explained in this verse. The living entity, the 17th element, is struggling alone, life after life. This struggle is called samsriti, or material conditioned life. In Bhagavad Gita, it is said that the force of material nature is insurmountably strong. Daivi yeshu gunamayi mama maya duratyaya. Material nature harasses the living entity in different bodies. But if the living entity surrenders to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he becomes free from this entanglement, as confirmed in Bhagavad Gita, Mame Valye Papadyam Te, Mayamatam Taranti Te. Thus, his life becomes successful. Om Jnana Timurandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshuran Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasudeva Gaura Bhaktivinoda. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So the verse again. This subtle body is endowed with 16 parts, the 5 knowledge-acquiring senses, the 5 working senses, the 5 objects of sense gratification, and the mind. This subtle body is an effect of the 3 modes of material nature. It is composed of insurmountably strong desires, and therefore it causes the living entity to transmigrate from one body to another in human life, animal life, and life as a demigod. When the living entity gets the body of a demigod, he is certainly very jubilant. When he gets a human body, he is always in lamentation. And when he gets the body of an animal, he is always afraid. In all conditions, however, he is actually miserable. His miserable condition is called samsruti, or transmigration in material life. So the devotee who was scheduled to give class today couldn't do it, so I was asked to step in short notice. Should I elevate this a little bit? Or should I just leave it? Okay. Thank you. So this is a very interesting verse. It describes the subtle body. According to the Vedic literature, we have a gross material body, a subtle material body, and then there's the soul. Bhaktivinoda Thakur distinguishes these with the term stula sharira, the gross material body, linga sharira, which is also used here, the subtle material body. And then there's the nitya sharira, which is the swarupa, or the eternal form of the soul. So sometimes people misunderstand the subtle body to just be mind, intelligence, and false ego. And Bhagavad Gita, Krishna describes the elements in a simple way. He says, Bhumar apa nala vayu kam mana buddhi evacha ahankariti ame binaprakrita ashtada. Krishna describes there's earth, air, water, fire, ether, mind, intelligence, and ego. And if we just consider those eight elements, then we might conclude, the body made of earth, water, fire, air, and ether is the gross physical body, and the body made of mind, intelligence, and false ego is the subtle material body. But when we expand the number of elements that are included in this Sankhya enumeration of the elements, then, as we see here, the senses, the jnanindriyas and the karmindriyas, the knowledge acquiring and acting senses, are considered part of the subtle body. So this means, the senses are actually subtle as well. And they act through the gross mechanical arrangements of the body. So if we look at one of the jnanindriyas, the sense of vision, we can understand that, it isn't just the ball, two little balls that are of flesh that are sitting in the sockets in our skull. That's not the actual visual sense. The subtle visual sense is actually part of the subtle body. All the senses are grouped around the mind. The five knowledge acquiring senses and the five working senses are actually grouped around the mind. They're part of the subtle body. So just as the subtle visual sense operates through the two little balls of flesh that we have sitting in our skull, and the hearing sense operates through you know, these ears and the eardrum and the little bones and the that are there in the ear. The actual sense is something different. It's part of the subtle body. And it's also the same with the working senses. For example, there's the grasping sense. and it operates through the arm. But the actual subtle arm, subtle grasping sense is part of the subtle body. And this is, you know, there's some, actually a medical phenomenon that demonstrates this, and it's a medical phenomenon called phantom limbs. Because sometimes people will lose a limb, unfortunately, but they still perceive that they have it. You know, they can, and sometimes they actually feel pain, localized pain in their subtle arm, you know, that they still have. They still feel that they have, and doctors have to give them medicine, you know, for it. And even in cases where people are born without an arm or without arms, they also feel this phantom limb. It's very difficult to explain in terms of the ordinary scientific understanding of these things. And I've mentioned this before, but once I was at a conference where I was talking about these things, and a medical doctor was speaking to me later, and he said, and he wasn't really aware of Vedic philosophy at all, and he says, yes, this is a fact, this phantom limb phenomenon is a fact. And he said, sometimes people report having four arms. You know, he knew nothing about Vedic philosophy, but so this is, this whole phenomenon is explained in some detail in the allegory of the City of Nine Gates in the fourth canto of, you know, the Srimad Bhagavatam. You know, the same description of the what the subtle body actually is explained there in some detail. You know, there in the allegory, there's this king, Paranjana, leaves his home, and he's followed by his unknown friend, a brahmana, follows him secretly, just to keep an eye on him, see where he goes. So he goes looking for a new home, and he comes to this city of nine gates, and he goes inside the city, and there's a nice garden there. And in the garden, he sees a beautiful young woman, and he becomes attracted to her. She becomes attracted to him, but he's a little bit cautious because she's not alone. She's got 10 big, strong bodyguards. And then there's a chief bodyguard who's bigger and stronger than all the rest. And then there's this big serpent with 5 heads. And then there's thousands of maidservants kind of hanging around. So, you know, the king says, I mean, she says, well, my dear king, why don't you stay here in this city with me, and we can enjoy it together. It's husband and wife. And the king, he thought, well, it's an interesting proposal, but I like you, but who are all these other personalities around? He said, but she said, oh, don't mind them. They've always been here. They don't bother me. You know, you just... So the king agrees to stay in the city, and the king and the queen lived peacefully in the city for some time, and then suddenly a king named Kalayavana appears at the walls of the city and attacks it with his 360 white soldiers and 360 black soldiers. And for some time, the king defends the city, but eventually the attacking soldiers break down the walls, burn the city, take the king and the queen captive, and drag them out of the city, along with the 10 bodyguards, the chief bodyguard, the serpent with five heads, and all the maidservants. So Narada Muni explains what the allegory means. You know, King Paranjana is the spirit soul, and he leaves his original home. Krishna Bahir Mukahana Bhogavanchakari Nikatashta Mayatari Japatiyatari. This means the soul turns from Krishna, and as soon as the soul turns from Krishna, Maya is there to capture him. And but although the soul leaves Krishna, Krishna doesn't leave the soul. It follows the soul as the super soul, his unknown friend. So that's what the unknown friend is, the super soul who's just observing. And the city of nine gates is the material body. And this, you know, material body has nine gates, at least in the male form. It's got nine gates, two eyes, two ears, mouth, two nostrils, the holes for evacuation and reproduction. So it's the city of nine gates, made of matter. And the queen represents the material intelligence. Can also represent spiritual intelligence, but in the first instance it represents material. The queen represents material intelligence. The 10 bodyguards are the Gyanendriyas and the Karmendriyas, the knowledge acquiring senses and the senses of action, the working senses. And the chief bodyguard represents the mind, because the senses are all grouped around the mind. And the serpent with five heads represents the five principal airs that circulate, you know, in the body. And the maidservants, the thousands of maidservants, represent all the material desires. And, you know, read in this verse, the subtle body is an effect of the three modes of material nature. It is composed of insurmountably strong desires. So these unlimited desires, you know, are personified in the allegory by, you know, the different maidservants. So the attacking king, Kalayavana, represents the time factor, death, and his got his 360 black soldiers and white soldiers represents the days and nights that are constantly passing. And Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Kalosmi Lokashaya Krit, time I am, destroyer of everything in the material world. So gradually, this force of time destroys the city of nine gates. And then what happens? Well, it's said that the king and the queen and the bodyguards and the head chief bodyguard are all captured and taken out of the city. So that indicates, that's another example showing how the subtle body, the subtle material body, is not just composed of mind, intelligence, and false ego, which is a simple conception. They definitely are part of the subtle material body, but the subtle material body also includes the subtle knowledge-acquiring senses and the subtle working senses, and it also includes the desires. So that whole apparatus is the subtle body. And then based on the condition of the subtle body and divine arrangement, the soul will get another material body, you know, based on its, you know, the state of, you know, the subtle body. Then in, you know, for example, maybe, you know, the different possibilities are, you know, described here in this verse. You know, one could get the body of a demigod or another human being or an animal. So if we assume that this particular soul gets an animal body, for example, the body of a dog. So those subtle senses, subtle knowledge-acquiring senses, are still there. They're part of the subtle body. And then when the subtle body and the soul enter the body of the dog, then the subtle visual sense will operate through the eyes of a dog. The subtle hearing sense will operate through, you know, the hearing of the dog. And, you know, dogs, supposedly, they can hear things that ordinary humans can't hear. They can hear ultrasound. And the subtle smelling sense will operate through the nose of the dog. And it's much more powerful sense of smell than human beings have. You know, dogs can smell a lot more. And then, you know, the taste, you know, the sense of taste will operate through the tongue of the dog, and so on. And then the working senses, you know, the vocal sense will operate through the dog's vocal apparatus, its throat and mouth. And we see in our human form, we can make a lot of different sounds, and we can speak, you know, in very complex ways. But in the dog's body, can't produce such complex sounds. So just go, woof, woof, or whatever. And then the arrangement of the arms and legs is a little different, you know, in the dog's body. Instead of walking on two legs and arranging things with the arms, you know, the subtle grasping and walking senses will operate through the four legs of the dog, and so on. So this whole subtle apparatus of the subtle material body, the linga sharira, is there. And if for some reason a soul does not immediately get another gross material body, for example, you know, there could be various reasons, according to the Vedic philosophy, why a soul might not get another gross physical body, then it remains in the body of a ghost. And then it has all these senses and desires, but it's not able to fulfill them in the normal way by making use of the machinery of the gross physical body. So it's not a very comfortable position to be in. Therefore, there's, you know, in Vedic culture, there's this ritual, Shraddha ritual, where they offer pinda to the forefathers in case, just in case, sort of as insurance, that if some ancestor is stuck in the body of a ghost, doesn't have a material body, it will get a body. Of course, Srila Prabhupada said if we're chanting the Hare Krishna mantra, we're automatically performing, you know, all these types of rituals. But that is there. And sometimes these ghosts, you know, because they have these senses and they have the desires, but they're not able to use them, will try to possess, you know, the body of some living human. And this can happen sometimes, especially if a human is weakened by intoxication and madness, then they can become possessed. And Srila Prabhupada talked a few times about ghosts that he was aware of in John Lennon's house, for example, or when he was a business in his householder life, he got a good deal on a house because it was haunted. Normally the house would rent for thousands of rupees, the building. But he went to the owner and said, well, it's a haunted house. I'll give you a few hundred rupees for it. So he did that, and then he chanted Hare Krishna and scared the ghost away. Got a good deal on it. That may be common in India. It's not so common here. Yeah. Okay. So I'll stop there. Anybody have any? Archito?
But it seems that Lord Chaitanya, who's instituted this chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra, he observed those rituals. So should we, in spite of the fact that we're chanting, still observe all those rituals? Or is it like Prabhupada in the case of the Krishna Balaram Mandir, where he said, we didn't have to do this elaborate sacrifice, we're doing it just to satisfy the people, we could have just chanted Hare Krishna and installed the deities that way. So, I mean, what do we follow? How do we know how to proceed? Should we really institute all these traditional functions like, you know, Shraddha and stuff like that, or can we just chant Hare Krishna and forget about them?
Well, I was speaking not about all rituals. I was specifically speaking about this Shraddha ceremony. And if we look at the whole range of Vedic culture, we'll see there's unlimited rituals. You know, there's thousands. And if we followed all of them, that's all we'd be doing all day long. We'd just be... So our acharyas have established a principle. The six Goswamis, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, others, they established a principle that we should... The main thing is the practice of devotional service, you know, as it's presented in the Vaishnava Smriti. It's, you know, the hearing, the chanting, remembering, all these things. This is the main thing. But we can accept those rituals that help with that and don't interfere with that. So how do we know that? You know, which ones to adopt and which ones not to adopt? The surest guide is following the process of Krishna consciousness as it was given to us by, you know, our founder Acharya, Srila Prabhupada. And about this specific ritual, the Shraddha ritual, you know, he specifically said there's no need for us to follow it, because if we're practicing devotional service, then our ancestors and descendants, you know, for many generations going back and many generations going forward will be taken care of in terms of any difficulty they might, you know, be in terms of not having body. So that's the reason I said that. Of course, these things can be discussed. You know, we have a system, authority system. If maybe they decide these things should be instituted, maybe we will. But Prabhupada's instruction was there that it's not necessary for devotees. I don't think he forbade it, but he said it wasn't necessary. So, Svavas?
Thank you for a wonderful class, Prabhu. In your class, when you were speaking about the body and the subtle body, it reminded me of a lecture I heard by Srila Prabhupada, and that question was asked to Prabhupada, what is the soul like? What is the form of the soul? And Prabhupada gave the example of like the body that we have. We have like a shirt, and that shirt is made with sleeves, and we have legs, and we have made pants that cover the legs. So Prabhupada said that the form of this body is actually the form of the soul, and the soul within the body. That's, in other words, trying to think, well, what does the soul look like? It actually looks like it is like our body, except that it's eternal, and it fits within this particular body. So I thought it was pretty interesting kind of example of how to understand. And then when you said that someone's arms are missing, they still feel that they have that arm or that leg or whatever. It's actually probably part of the whole conception of the soul in itself. It's actually there, and that's its form.
Yeah, ultimately it's something like that. Although the subtle material body is still material, but the example you gave still holds. Well, why is it like that? It's ultimately because the soul has form. The soul has, you know, there's, Srila Prabhupada said there's spiritual mind, there's spiritual intelligence, there's spiritual senses. So it's not that in the liberated state, you know, there aren't any senses. There's no form, no body. There's a spiritual body, as Bhaktivinoda Thakur called it, Nitya Sharira. And, you know, there's statements in Shastra, Muktir Hitvan Yuta Rupam Swarupena Vyavastiti. It means liberation, means, you know, giving up the false forms and being situated in the real form. So there is a real form, a swa rupa, that is spiritual, sat chit ananda vigraha, just like Krishna has his sat chit ananda vigraha, his form of eternity, knowledge, and bliss. So each individual soul, being part and parcel of Krishna, has its eternal, blissful, knowledge-filled, eternal form. Okay, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.